In that case, we have quite another fate in store for you. Such love, such care. The element of the wish for obliteration can be seen without disguise in the millennial sects of our own day, who betray their selfishness as well as their nihilism by announcing how many will be saved from the ultimate catastrophe. Here, the extreme Protestants are almost as much at fault as the most hysterical Muslims. In 1844, one of the greatest American religious revivals occurred, led by a semi-literate lunatic named George Miller. Mr. Miller managed to crowd the mountaintops of America with credulous fools who, having sold their belongings cheap, became persuaded that the world would end on October 22nd of that year. They removed themselves to high ground. What difference did they expect that to make? Or to the roofs of their hovels? When the ultimate failed to arrive, Miller's choice of terms was highly suggestive. It was, he announced, the great disappointment. In our own time, Mr. Hal Lindsey, author of the best-selling The Late Great Planet Earth, has betrayed the same thirst for extinction. Indulged by senior American conservatives and respectfully interviewed on TV, Mr. Lindsey once dated the start of The Tribulation, a seven-year period of strife and terror, for 1988. That would have produced Armageddon itself, the closure of The Tribulation, in 1995. Mr. Lindsey may be a charlatan, but it is a certainty that he and his followers suffer from a persistent feeling of anticlimax. Antibodies to fatalism and suicide and masochism do exist, however, and are just as innate in our species. There is a celebrated story from Puritan Massachusetts in the late 18th century. During a session of the state legislature, the sky suddenly became leaden and overcast at midday. Its threatening aspect, a darkness at noon, convinced many legislators that the event so much on their clouded minds was imminent. They asked to suspend business and to go home to die. The Speaker of the Assembly, Abraham Davenport, managed to keep his nerve and dignity. "Gentlemen," he said, "either the day of judgment is here or it is not. If it is not, there is no occasion for alarm and lamentation. If it is, however, I wish to be found doing my duty. I move, therefore, that candles be brought." In his own limited and superstitious day, this was the best that Mr. Davenport could do. Nonetheless, I second his motion. Chapter 5. The metaphysical claims of religion are false. "I am a man of one book," Thomas Aquinas. "We sacrifice the intellect to God," Ignatius Loyola. "Reason is the devil's harlot, who can do naught but slander and harm, whatever God says and does," Martin Luther. "Looking up at the stars, I know quite well that for all they care, I can go to hell," W. H. Auden, the more loving one. I wrote earlier that we would never again have to confront the impressive faith of an Aquinas or a Maimonides, as contrasted with the blind faith of millennial or absolutist sects, of which we have an apparently unlimited and infinitely renewable supply. This is for a simple reason. Faith of that sort, the sort that can stand up at least for a while in a confrontation with reason, is now plainly impossible. The early fathers of faith, they made very sure there'd be no mothers, were living in a time of abysmal ignorance and fear. Maimonides did not include in his Guide to the Perplexed those whom he described as not worth the effort, the Turkish and black and nomadic peoples whose nature is like the nature of mute animals. Aquinas half believed in astrology and was convinced that the fully formed nucleus, not that he would have known the word as we do, of a human being was contained inside each individual sperm. One can only mourn over the dismal and stupid lectures on sexual continence that we might have been spared if this nonsense had been exposed earlier than it was. Augustine was a self-centered fantasist and an earth-centered ignoramus. He was guiltily convinced that God cared about his trivial theft from some unimportant pear trees, and quite persuaded, by an analogous solipsism, that the sun revolved around the earth. He also fabricated the mad and cruel idea that the souls of unbaptized children were sent to limbo. Who can guess the load of misery that this diseased theory has placed on millions of Catholic parents down the years, until its shamefaced and only partial revision by the Church in our own time? Luther was terrified of demons and believed that the mentally afflicted were the devil's work. Muhammad is claimed by his own followers to have thought, as did Jesus, that the desert was pullulating with jinns, or evil spirits. One must state it plainly. Religion comes from the period of human prehistory where nobody, not even the mighty Democritus, who concluded that all matter was made from atoms, had the smallest idea what was going on. It comes from the bawling and fearful infancy of our species and is a babyish attempt to meet our inescapable demand for knowledge, as well as for comfort, reassurance, and other infantile needs. Today, the least educated of my children knows much more about the natural order than any of the founders of religion. And one would like to think, though the connection is not a fully demonstrable one, that this is why they seem so uninterested in sending fellow humans to hell. All attempts to reconcile faith with science and reason are consigned to failure and ridicule for precisely these reasons. I read, for example, of some ecumenical conference of Christians who desire to show their broad-mindedness and invite some physicists along, but I am compelled to remember what I know, which is that there would be no such churches in the first place if humanity had not been afraid of the weather, the dark, the plague, the eclipse, and all manner of other things now easily explicable. And also if humanity had not been compelled, on pain of extremely agonizing consequences, to pay the exorbitant tithes and taxes that raised the imposing edifices of religion. It is true that scientists have sometimes been religious or at any rate superstitious. Sir Isaac Newton, for example, was a spiritualist and alchemist of a particularly laughable kind. Fred Hoyle, an ex-agnostic who became infatuated with the idea of design, was the Cambridge astronomer who coined the term Big Bang. He came up with that silly phrase, incidentally, as an attempt to discredit what is now the accepted theory of the origins of the universe. This was one of those lampoons that, so to speak, backfired, since, like Tory and Impressionist and Suffragette, it became adopted by those at whom it was directed. Stephen Hawking is not a believer, and when invited to Rome to meet the late Pope John Paul II, asked to be shown the records of the trial of Galileo. But even he can speak without embarrassment of the chance of physics knowing the mind of God. And this now seems quite harmless as a metaphor, as, for example, when the Beach Boys sing, or I say, God only knows. Before Charles Darwin revolutionized our entire concept of our origins, and Albert Einstein did the same for the beginnings of our cosmos, many scientists and philosophers and mathematicians took what might be called the default position and professed one or other version of deism, which held that the order and predictability of the universe seemed indeed to imply a designer, if not necessarily a designer, who took any active part in human affairs. This compromise was a logical and rational one for its time, and was especially influential among the Philadelphia and Virginia intellectuals, such as Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, who managed to seize a moment of crisis and use it to enshrine Enlightenment values in the founding documents of the United States of America. Yet, as St. Paul so unforgettably said, when one is a child, one speaks and thinks as a child, but when one becomes a man, one puts away childish things. It is not quite possible to locate the exact moment when men of learning stopped spinning the coin as between a creator and a long, complex process, or ceased trying to split the deistic difference. But humanity began to grow up a little in the closing decades of the 18th century and the opening decades of the 19th. Charles Darwin was born in 1809, on the very same day as Abraham Lincoln, and there is no doubt as to which of them has proved to be the greater emancipator. If one had to emulate the foolishness of Archbishop Usher and try to come up with the exact date on which the conceptual coin came down solidly on one side, it would be the moment when Pierre-Simon de Laplace was invited to meet Napoleon Bonaparte. Laplace, born in 1749 and dying in 1827, was the brilliant French scientist who took the work of Newton a stage further and showed by means of mathematical calculus how the operations of the solar system were those of bodies revolving systematically in a vacuum. When he later turned his attention to the stars and the nebulae, he postulated the idea of gravitational collapse and implosion, or what we now breezily term the black hole. In a 5-volume book entitled Celestial Mechanics, he laid all this out, and like many men of his time, was also intrigued by the orrery, a working model of the solar system as seen, for the first time, from the outside. These are now commonplace, but were then revolutionary, and the emperor asked to meet Laplace in order to be given either a set of the books or, accounts differ, a version of the orrery. I personally suspect that the gravedigger of the French Revolution wanted the toy rather than the volumes, He was a man in a hurry, and had managed to get the church to baptize his dictatorship with a crown. At any event, and in his childish and demanding and imperious fashion, he wanted to know why the figure of God did not appear in Laplace's mind-expanding calculations. And there came the cool, lofty, and considered response. Je n'ai pas besoin de cette hypothèse. Laplace was to become a marquis, and could perhaps more modestly have said, it works well enough without that idea, Your Majesty, but he simply stated that he did not need it. And neither do we. The decay and collapse and discredit of God worship does not begin at any dramatic moment, such as Nietzsche's histrionic and self-contradictory pronouncement that God was dead. Nietzsche could no more have known this or made the assumption that God had ever been alive than a priest or witch doctor could ever declare that he knew God's will. Rather, the end of God worship discloses itself at the moment, which is somewhat more gradually revealed, when it becomes optional, or only one among many possible beliefs. For the greater part of human existence, it must always be stressed, this option did not really exist. We know from the many fragments of their burned and mutilated texts and confessions that there were always human beings who were unconvinced. But from the time of Socrates, who was condemned to death for spreading unwholesome skepticism, it was considered ill-advised to emulate his example. And for billions of people down the ages, the question simply did not come up. The votaries of Baron Samedi in Haiti enjoyed the same monopoly, founded upon the same brute coercion, as did those of John Calvin in Geneva or Massachusetts. I select these examples because they are yesterday in terms of human time. Many religions now come before us with ingratiating smirks and outspread hands, like an unctuous merchant in a bazaar. They offer consolation and solidarity and uplift, competing as they do in a marketplace. But we have a right to remember how barbarically they behaved when they were strong and were making an offer that people could not refuse. And if we chance to forget what that must have been like, we have only to look to those states and societies where the clergy still has the power to dictate its own terms. The pathetic vestiges of this can still be seen in modern societies in the efforts made by religion to secure control over education, or to exempt itself from tax, or to pass laws forbidding people to insult its omnipotent and omniscient deity, or even his prophet. In our new semi-secular and mediocre condition, even the religious will speak with embarrassment of the time when theologians would dispute over futile propositions with fanatical intensity, measuring the length of angels' wings, for example, or debating how many such mythical creatures could dance on the head of a pin. Of course, it's horrifying to remember how many people were tortured and killed, and how many sources of knowledge fed to the flames in bogus arguments over the Trinity, or the Muslim Hadith, or the arrival of a false Messiah. But it is better for us not to fall into relativism, or what E.P. Thompson called the enormous condescension of posterity. The scholastic obsessives of the Middle Ages were doing the best they could on the basis of hopelessly limited information, ever-present fear of death and judgment, very low life expectancy, and an audience of illiterates. Living in often genuine fear of the consequences of error, they exerted their minds to the fullest extent then possible and evolved quite impressive systems of logic and the dialectic. It is not the fault of men like Peter Abelard if they had to work with bits and pieces of Aristotle, many of whose writings were lost when the Christian emperor Justinian closed the schools of philosophy, but were preserved in Arabic translation in Baghdad and then retransmitted to a benighted Christian Europe by way of Jewish and Muslim Andalusia. When they got hold of the material and reluctantly conceded that there had been intelligent discussion of ethics and morality before the supposed advent of Jesus, they tried their hardest to square the circle. We have nothing much to learn from what they thought, but a great deal to learn from how they thought. One medieval philosopher and theologian who continues to speak eloquently across the ages is William Ockham, sometimes known as William of Ockham, and presumably named after his native village in Surrey, England, that still boasts the name. He was born on a date unknown to us and died, probably in great agony and fear, and probably of the horrific Black Death, in Munich in 1349. He was a Franciscan, in other words an acolyte, of the aforementioned mammal who was said to have preached to birds, and thus conditioned to a radical approach to poverty, which brought him into collision with the papacy in Avignon in 1324. The quarrel between the papacy and the emperor over secular and ecclesiastical division of powers is irrelevant to us now, since both sides ultimately lost, But Ockham was forced to seek even the emperor's protection in face of the worldliness of the pope. Faced with charges of heresy and the threat of excommunication, he had the fortitude to respond that the pope himself was the heretic. Nonetheless, and because he always argued within the enclosed frame of Christian reference, he is admitted even by the most orthodox Christian authorities to have been an original and courageous thinker. He was interested, for example, in the stars. He knew far less about the nebulae than we do, or than Laplace did. In fact, he knew nothing about them at all. But he employed them for an interesting speculation. Assuming that God can make us feel the presence of a non-existent entity, and further assuming that he need not go to this trouble if the same effect can be produced in us by the actual presence of that entity, God could still, if he wished, cause us to believe in the existence of stars without their being actually present. Every effect which God causes, through the mediation of a secondary cause, he can produce immediately by himself. However, this does not mean that we must believe in anything absurd, since God cannot cause in us knowledge such that by it a thing is seen evidently to be present, though it is absent, for that involves a contradiction. Before you begin to drum your fingers at the huge tautology that impends here, as it does in so much theology and theodicy, consider what Father Copleston, the eminent Jesuit, has to say in commentary. If God had annihilated the stars, he could still cause in us the act of seeing what had once been, so far as the act is considered subjectively, just as he could give us a vision of what will be in the future. Either act would be an immediate apprehension, in the first case of what has been, and in the second case of what will be. This is actually very impressive, and not just for its time. It has taken us several hundred years since Ockham to come to the realization that when we gaze up at the stars, we very often are seeing light from distant bodies that have long since ceased to exist. It doesn't particularly matter that the right to look through telescopes and speculate about the result was obstructed by the Church. This is not Ockham's fault, and there is no general law that obliges the Church to be that stupid. And moving from the unimaginable interstellar past, which sends light across distances that overwhelm our brains, we have come to the realization that we also know something about the future of our system, including the rate of its expansion and the notion of its eventual terminus. However, and crucially, we can now do this while dropping, or even if you insist, retaining, the idea of a God. But in either case, the theory works without that assumption. You can believe in a divine mover, if you choose, but it makes no difference at all. And belief among astronomers and physicists has become private and fairly rare. It was actually Ockham who prepared our minds for this unwelcome, to him, conclusion. He devised a principle of economy, popularly known as Ockham's razor, which relied for its effect on disposing of unnecessary assumptions and accepting the first sufficient explanation or cause. Do not multiply entities beyond necessity. This principle extends itself. Everything which is explained through positing something different from the act of understanding, he wrote, can be explained without positing such a distinct thing. He was not afraid to follow his own logic, wherever it might take him, and anticipated the coming of true science when he agreed that it was possible to know the nature of created things without any reference to their creator. Indeed, Ockham stated that it cannot be strictly proved that God, if defined as a being who possesses the qualities of supremacy, perfection, uniqueness, and infinity, exists at all. However, if one intends to identify a first cause of the existence of the world, one may choose to call that God, even if one does not know the precise nature of the first cause. And even the first cause has its difficulties, since a cause will itself need another cause. It is difficult or impossible, he wrote, to prove against the philosophers that there cannot be an infinite regress in causes of the same kind, of which one can exist without the other. Thus the postulate of a designer or creator only raises the unanswerable question of who designed the designer or created the creator. Religion and theology and theodicy, this is now me talking and not Ockham, have consistently failed to overcome this objection. Ockham himself simply had to fall back on the hopeless position that the existence of God can only be demonstrated by faith. Credo quia absurdum, as the Church Father Tertullian put it, either disarmingly or annoyingly, according to your taste. I believe it because it is absurd. It is impossible to quarrel seriously with such a view. If one must have faith in order to believe something, or believe in something, then the likelihood of that something having any truth or value is considerably diminished. The harder work of inquiry, proof, and demonstration is infinitely more rewarding, and has confronted us with findings far more miraculous and transcendent than any theology. Actually, the leap of faith, to give it the memorable name that Søren Kierkegaard bestowed upon it, is an imposture. As he himself pointed out, it is not a leap that can be made once and for all. It is a leap that has to go on and on being performed in spite of mounting evidence to the contrary. This effort is actually too much for the human mind, and leads to delusions and manias. Religion understands perfectly well that the leap is subject to sharply diminishing returns, which is why it often doesn't in fact rely on faith at all, but instead corrupts faith and insults reason by offering evidence and pointing to confected proofs. This evidence and these proofs include arguments from design, revelations, punishments, and miracles. Now that religion's monopoly has been broken, it is within the compass of any human being to see these evidences and proofs as the feeble-minded inventions that they are. Chapter 6. Arguments from Design. All my moral and intellectual being is penetrated by an invincible conviction that whatever falls under the dominion of our senses must be in nature and, however exceptional, cannot differ in its essence from all the other effects of the visible and tangible world of which we are a self-conscious part. The world of the living contains enough marvels and mysteries as it is, marvels and mysteries acting upon our emotions and intelligence in ways so inexplicable that it would almost justify the conception of life as an enchanted state. No, I am too firm in my consciousness of the marvelous to be ever fascinated by the mere supernatural, which, take it any way you like, is but a manufactured article, the fabrication of minds insensitive to the intimate delicacies of our relation to the dead and to the living in their countless multitudes, a desecration of our tenderest memories, an outrage on our dignity. Joseph Conrad, author's note to The Shadow Line. There is a central paradox at the core of religion. The three great monotheisms teach people to think abjectly of themselves, as miserable and guilty sinners prostrate before an angry and jealous God who, according to discrepant accounts, fashioned them either out of dust and clay or a clot of blood. The positions for prayer are usually emulations of the supplicant serf before an ill-tempered monarch. The message is one of continual submission, gratitude, and fear. Life itself is a poor thing, an interval in which to prepare for the hereafter, or for the coming, or second coming, of the Messiah. On the other hand, and as if by way of compensation, religion teaches people to be extremely self-centered and conceited. It assures them that God cares for them individually, and it claims that the cosmos was created with them specifically in mind. This explains the supercilious expression on the faces of those who practice religion ostentatiously. Pray excuse my modesty and humility, but I happen to be busy on an errand for God. Since human beings are naturally solipsistic, all forms of superstition enjoy what might be called a natural advantage. In the United States, we exert ourselves to improve high-rise buildings and high-speed jet aircraft, the two achievements that the murderers of September 11, 2001 put into hostile apposition, and then pathetically refuse to give them floors or row numbers that carry the unimportant number 13. I know that Pythagoras refuted astrology by the simple means of pointing out that identical twins do not have the same future. I further know that the zodiac was drawn up long before several of the planets in our solar system had been detected, and of course I understand that I could not be shown my immediate or long-term future without this disclosure altering the outcome. Thousands of people consult their stars in the newspapers every day and then have unpredicted heart attacks or traffic accidents. An astrologer on a London tabloid was once fired by means of a letter from his editor which began, "As you will no doubt have foreseen." In his Minima Moralia, Theodore Adorno identified the interest in stargazing as the consummation of feeble-mindedness. However, happening to glance at the projected situation for Aries one morning, as I once did, to be told that a member of the opposite sex is interested and will show it, I found it hard to suppress a tiny surge of idiotic excitement, which in my memory has outlived the later disappointment. Then again, every time I leave my apartment, there is no sign of a bus, whereas every time I return to it, a bus is just drawing up. In bad moods, I mutter, just my luck to myself, even though part of my small 2 or 3 pound brain reminds me that the mass transit schedule of Washington, D.C. is drawn up and implemented without any reference to my movements. I mention this in case it might later become important. If I am hit by a bus on the day this book is published, there will certainly be people who will say it was no accident. So why should I not be tempted to overrule W.H. Auden and believe that the firmament is in some mysterious way ordered for my benefit? Or, coming down by a few orders of magnitude, that fluctuations in my personal fortunes are of absorbing interest to a supreme being? One of the many faults in my design is my propensity to believe or to wish this, and though, like many people, I have enough education to see through the fallacy, I have to admit that it is innate. In Sri Lanka once, I was travelling in a car with a group of Tamils on a relief expedition to a Tamil area of the coastline that had been hard hit by a cyclone. My companions were all members of the Sai Baba sect, which is very strong in South India and Sri Lanka. Sai Baba himself has claimed to raise the dead and makes a special on-camera performance of producing holy ash from his bare palms. Why ash? I used to wonder. Anyway, the trip began with my friends breaking some coconuts on a rock to ensure a safe journey. This evidently did not work because halfway across the island, our driver ploughed straight into a man who staggered out in front of us as we were racing too fast through a village. The man was horribly injured and, this being a Sinhala village, the crowd that instantly gathered was not well disposed to these Tamil intruders. It was a very sticky situation, but I was able to defuse it somewhat by being an Englishman wearing an off-white Graham Greene type suit and by having press credentials that had been issued by the London Metropolitan Police. This impressed the local cop enough to have us temporarily released, and my companions, who had been very scared indeed, were more than grateful for my presence and for my ability to talk fast. In fact, they telephoned their cult headquarters to announce that Sai Baba himself had been with us in the temporary shape of my own person. From then on, I was treated literally with reverence and not allowed to carry anything or fetch my own food. It did occur to me meanwhile to check on the man we had run over. He had died of his injuries in hospital. I wonder what his horoscope had foreshadowed for that day. Thus, in miniature, I saw how one mere human mammal, myself, can suddenly begin to attract shy glances of awe and wonder, and how another human mammal, our luckless victim, could be somehow irrelevant to Sai Baba's benign design. "There, but for the grace of God," said John Bradford in the 16th century, on seeing wretches led to execution, "go I." What this apparently compassionate observation really means, not that it really means anything, is, "there by the grace of God goes someone else." As I was writing this chapter, a heart-stopping accident took place in a coal mine in West Virginia. 13 miners survived the explosion, but were trapped underground, compelling the nation's attention for a whole fraught news cycle until with huge relief it was announced that they had been located safe and sound. These glad tidings turned out to be premature, which was an impossible additional anguish for the families who had already begun celebrating and giving thanks before discovering that all but one of their menfolk had suffocated under the rock. It was also an embarrassment to the newspapers and news bulletins that had rushed out too soon with the false consolation. And can you guess what the headline on those newspapers and bulletins had been? Of course you can. Miracle, with or without the exclamation point, was the invariable choice, surviving mockingly in print and in the memory to intensify the grief of the relatives. There doesn't seem to be a word to describe the absence of divine intervention in this case. But the human wish to credit good things as miraculous and to charge bad things to another account is apparently universal. In England, the monarch is the hereditary head of the church as well as the hereditary head of the state. William Cobbett once pointed out that the English themselves colluded in this servile absurdity by referring to the royal mint but the national debt. Religion plays the same trick and in the same way and before our very eyes. On my first visit to the Sacré-Cœur in Montmartre, a church that was built to celebrate the deliverance of Paris from the Prussians and the Commune of 1870 to 1871, I saw a panel in bronze which showed the exact pattern in which a shower of Allied bombs, dropped in 1944, had missed the church and burst in the adjoining neighbourhood. Given this overwhelming tendency to stupidity and selfishness in myself and among our species, it is somewhat surprising to find the light of reason penetrating at all. The brilliant Schiller was wrong in his Joan of Arc when he said that against stupidity the gods themselves contend in vain. It is actually by means of the gods that we make our stupidity and gullibility into something ineffable. The design arguments, which are products of this same solipsism, take two forms, the macro and the micro. They were most famously summarised by William Paley, whose dates are 1743 to 1805, in his book Natural Philosophy. Here we encounter the homespun example of the primitive human who stumbles across a ticking watch. He may not know what it is for, but he can discern that it is not a rock or a vegetable, and that it has been manufactured, and even manufactured for some purpose. Paley wanted to extend this analogy both to nature and to man. His complacency and wrong-headedness are well caught by J.G. Farrell in his portrait of a Paley-trained Victorian divine in The Siege of Krishnapur. How do you explain the subtle mechanism of the eye, infinitely more complex than the mere telescope that miserable humanity has been able to invent? How do you explain the eel's eye, which might be damaged by burrowing into mud and stones, and is therefore protected by a transparent horny covering? How is it that the iris of a fish's eye does not contract? Ah, poor misguided youth, it is because the fish's eye has been designed by him who is above all, to suit the dim light in which the fish makes his watery dwelling. How do you explain the Indian hog? He cried. How do you account for its two bent teeth, more than a yard long, growing upwards from its upper jaw? To defend itself? No, young man, it has two tusks for that purpose, issuing from the lower jaw like those of a common boar. No, the answer is that the animal sleeps standing up, and, in order to support its head, it hooks its upper tusks on the branches of the trees, for the designer of the world has given thought even to the hog's slumbers. Paley did not bother to explain how the designer of the world came to command so many of his human creatures to treat the said hog as if it were a demon or a leper. In fact, surveying the natural order, John Stuart Mill was far nearer the mark when he wrote, "If a tenth part of the pains taken in finding signs of an all-powerful, benevolent God had been employed in collecting evidence to blacken the Creator's character, what scope would not have been found in the animal kingdom? It is divided into devourers and devoured, most creatures being lavishly fitted with instruments to torment their prey." Now that the courts have protected Americans, at least for the moment, from the inculcation of compulsory creationist stupidity in the classroom, we can echo that other great Victorian, Lord Macaulay, and say that every schoolchild knows that Paley had put his creaking, leaking cart in front of his wheezing and broken-down old horse. Fish do not have fins because they need them for the water, any more than birds are equipped with wings so that they can meet the dictionary definition of an avian. Apart from anything else, there are too many flightless species of birds. It is exactly the other way about, a process of adaption and selection. Let no one doubt the power of the original illusion. Whittaker Chambers, in his seismic book Witness, recounts the first moment when he abandoned historical materialism, mentally deserted the communist cause, and embarked on the career which would undo Stalinism in America. It was on the morning when he glimpsed the ear of his baby daughter. The pretty walls and folds of this external organ persuaded him, in a flash of revelation, that no coincidence could have created it. A fleshly flap of such utter beauty must be divine. Well, I too have marvelled at the sweet little ears of my female offspring, but never without noticing that A, they always need a bit of a clean-out, B, that they look mass-produced even when set against the inferior ears of other people's daughters, C, that as people get older their ears look more and more absurd from behind, and D, that much lower animals, such as cats and bats, have much more fascinating and lovely and more potent ears. To echo Laplace, in fact, I would say that there are many, many persuasive arguments against Stalin worship, but that the anti-Stalin case is fully valid without Mr. Chambers's ear-flap-based assumption. Ears are predictable and uniform, and their flaps are every bit as adorable when the child has been born stone-deaf. The same is not true in the same sense of the universe. Here there are anomalies and mysteries and imperfections, to use the most minimal terms, that do not even show adaptation, let alone selection. Thomas Jefferson in old age was fond of the analogy of the timepiece in his own case, and would write to friends who inquired after his health that the odd spring was breaking and the occasional wheel wearing out. This, of course, raises the uncomfortable, for believers, idea of the built-in fault that no repairman can fix. Should this be counted as part of the design as well? As usual, those who take the credit for the one will fall silent and start shuffling when it comes to the other side of the ledger. But when it comes to the whirling, howling wilderness of outer space, with its red giants and white dwarfs and black holes, its titanic explosions and extinctions, we can only dimly and shiveringly conclude that the design hasn't been imposed quite yet, and wonder if this is how dinosaurs felt when the meteors came smashing through the Earth's atmosphere and put an end to the pointless bellowing rivalry across primeval swamps. Even what was first known about the comparatively consoling symmetry of the solar system, with its nonetheless evident tendency to instability and entropy, upset Sir Isaac Newton enough to make him propose that God intervened every now and then to put the orbits back on an even keel. This exposed him to teasing from Leibniz, who asked why God couldn't have got it working right the first time around. It is indeed only because of the frightening emptiness elsewhere that we are bound to be impressed by the apparently unique and beautiful conditions that have allowed intelligent life to occur on Earth. But then, vain as we are, we would be impressed, wouldn't we? This vanity allows us to overlook the implacable fact that, of the other bodies in our own solar system alone, the rest are all either far too cold to support anything recognisable as life, or far too hot. The same, as it happens, is true of our own blue and rounded planetary home, where heat contends with cold to make large tracts of it into useless wasteland, and where we have come to learn that we live, and have always lived, on a climatic knife edge. Meanwhile, the sun is getting ready to explode and devour its dependent planets like some jealous chief or tribal deity. Some design. So much for the macro dimension. What of the micro? Ever since they were forced to take part in this argument, which they were with great reluctance, the religious have tried to echo Hamlet's admonition to Horatio that there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamed of by mere humans. Our side willingly concedes this point. We are prepared for discoveries in the future that will stagger our faculties even more than the vast advances in knowledge that have come to us since Darwin and Einstein. However, these discoveries will come to us in the same way, by means of patient and scrupulous, and this time, we hope, unfettered inquiry. In the meanwhile, we also have to improve our minds by the laborious exercise of refuting the latest foolishness contrived by the faithful. When the bones of prehistoric animals began to be discovered and scrutinized in the 19th century, there were those who said that the fossils had been placed in the rock by God in order to test our faith. This cannot be disproved. Nor can my own pet theory that, from the patterns of behavior that are observable, we may infer a design that makes planet Earth, all unknown to us, a prison colony and lunatic asylum that is employed as a dumping ground by far-off and superior civilizations. However, I was educated by Sir Karl Popper to believe that a theory that is unfalsifiable is to that extent a weak one. Now we are being told that astonishing features such as the human eye cannot be the result of, so to speak, blind chance. As it happens, the design faction have chosen an example that could not be bettered. We now know a great deal about the eye, and about which creatures have it and which do not, and why. I must here for a moment give way to my friend Dr. Michael Shermer. Evolution also posits that modern organisms should show a variety of structures from simple to complex, reflecting an evolutionary history rather than an instantaneous creation. The human eye, for example, is the result of a long and complex pathway that goes back hundreds of millions of years. Initially a simple eye spot with a handful of light-sensitive cells that provided information to the organism about an important source of the light, it developed into a recessed eye spot where a small surface indentation filled with light-sensitive cells provided additional data on the direction of light. Then into a deep recession eye spot, where additional cells at greater depth provide more accurate information about the environment. Then into a pinhole camera eye that is able to focus an image on the back of a deeply recessed layer of light-sensitive cells. Then into a pinhole lens eye that is able to focus the image. Then into a complex eye, found in such modern mammals as humans. All the intermediate stages of this process have been located in other creatures, and sophisticated computer models have been developed which have tested the theory and shown that it actually works. There is a further proof of the evolution of the eye, as Shermer points out. This is the ineptitude of its design. The anatomy of the human eye, in fact, shows anything but intelligence in its design. It is built upside down and backwards, requiring photons of light to travel through the cornea, lens, aqueous fluid, blood vessels, ganglion cells, amacrine cells, horizontal cells, and bipolar cells before they reach the light-sensitive rods and cones that transduce the light signal into neural impulses, which are then sent to the visual cortex at the back of the brain for processing into meaningful patterns. For optimal vision, why would an intelligent designer have built an eye upside down and backwards? It is because we evolved from sightless bacteria, now found to share our DNA, that we are so myopic. These are the same ill-designed optics, complete with deliberately designed retinal blind spot, through which earlier humans claimed to have seen miracles with their own eyes. The problem in those cases was located elsewhere in the cortex, but we must never forget Charles Darwin's injunction that even the most highly evolved of us will continue to carry the indelible stamp of their lowly origin. I would add to Shermer that though it is true we are the highest and smartest animals, Ospreys have eyes we have calculated to be 60 times more powerful and sophisticated than our own, and that blindness, often caused by microscopic parasites that are themselves miracles of ingenuity, is one of the oldest and most tragic disorders known to man. And why award the superior eye, or, in the case of the cat or bat, also the ear, to the inferior species? The osprey can swoop accurately on a fast-moving fish that it has detected underwater from many, many feet above, all the while manoeuvring with its extraordinary wings. Ospreys have almost been exterminated by man, while you yourself can be born as blind as a worm and still become a pious and observant Methodist, for example. To suppose that the eye, wrote Charles Darwin, with all its inimitable contrivances for adjusting the focus to different distances, for admitting different amounts of light, and for the correction of spherical and chromatic aberration, could have been formed by natural selection seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest possible degree. He wrote this in an essay entitled Organs of Extreme Perfection and Complication. Since that time, the evolution of the eye has become almost a separate department of study. And why should it not? It is immensely fascinating and rewarding to know that at least 40 different sets of eyes, and possibly 60 different sets, have evolved in quite distinct and parallel, if comparable, ways. Dr. Daniel Nielsen, perhaps the foremost authority on the subject, has found, among other things, that three entirely different groups of fish have independently developed four eyes. One of these sea creatures, Batholichnops exilis, possesses a pair of eyes that look outward, and another pair of eyes, set in the wall of the main two, that direct their gaze straight downward. This would be an encumbrance to most animals, but it has some obvious advantages for an aquatic one. And it is highly important to notice that the embryological development of the second set of eyes is not a copy or a miniature of the first set, but an entirely different evolution. As Dr. Nielsen puts it in a letter to Richard Dawkins, this species has reinvented the lens despite the fact that it already had one. It serves as a good support for the view that lenses are not difficult to evolve. A creative deity, of course, would have been more likely to double the complement of optics in the first place, which would have left us with nothing to wonder about or to discover. Or, as Darwin went on to say in the same essay, when it was first said that the sun stood still and the world turned round, the common sense of mankind declared the doctrine false. But the old saying of vox populi, vox Dei, as every philosopher knows, cannot be trusted in science. Reason tells me that, if numerous gradations from an imperfect and simple eye to one perfect and complex, each grade being useful to its possessor, can be shown to exist, as is certainly the case, if further, the eye ever slightly varies, and the variations be inherited, as is likewise certainly the case, and if such variations should ever be useful to any animal under changing conditions of life, then the difficulty of believing that a perfect and complex eye could be formed by natural selection, though insuperable by our imagination, cannot be considered real. We may smile slightly when we notice that Darwin wrote of the sun standing still and when we notice that he spoke of the eye's perfection, but only because we are fortunate enough to know more than he did. What is worth noting and retaining is his proper use of the sense of what is wondrous. The real miracle is that we, who share genes with the original bacteria that began life on the planet, have evolved as much as we have. Other creatures did not develop eyes at all, or developed extremely weak ones. There is an intriguing paradox here. Evolution does not have eyes, but it can create them. The brilliant Professor Francis Crick, one of the discoverers of the double helix, had a colleague named Leslie Orgel who encapsulated this paradox more elegantly than I can. Evolution, he said, is smarter than you are. But this compliment to the intelligence of natural selection is not by any means a concession to the stupid notion of intelligent design. Some of the results are extremely impressive, as we are bound to think in our own case. What a piece of work is a man, as Hamlet exclaims, before going on to contradict himself somewhat by describing the result as a quintessence of dust, both statements having the merit of being true. But the process by which the results are attained is slow and infinitely laborious, and has given us a DNA string which is crowded with useless junk and which has much in common with much lower creatures. The stamp of the lowly origin is to be found in our appendix, in the now needless coat of hair that we still grow and then shed after 5 months in the womb, in our easily worn-out knees, our vestigial tails, and the many caprices of our urogenital arrangements. Why do people keep saying God is in the details? He isn't in ours, unless his yokel creationist fans wish to take credit for his clumsiness, failure, and incompetence. Those who have yielded, not without a struggle, to the overwhelming evidence of evolution are now trying to award themselves a medal for their own acceptance of defeat. The very magnificence and variety of the process, they now wish to say, argues for a directing and originating mind. In this way they choose to make a fumbling fool of their pretended God, and make him out to be a tinkerer, an approximator, and a blunderer, who took eons of time to fashion a few serviceable figures and heaped up a junkyard of failure and scrap meanwhile. Have they no more respect for the deity than that? They unwisely say that evolutionary biology is only a theory, which betrays their ignorance of the meaning of the word theory as well as of the meaning of the word design. A theory is something evolved, if you forgive the expression, to fit the known facts. It is a successful theory if it survives the introduction of hitherto unknown facts. And it becomes an accepted theory if it can make accurate predictions about things or events that have not yet been discovered or have not yet occurred. This can take time and is also subject to a version of Occam's procedure. Pharaonic astronomers in Egypt could predict eclipses, even though they believed the Earth to be flat. It just took them a great deal more unnecessary work. Einstein's prediction of the precise angular deflection of starlight due to gravity, verified during an eclipse off the west coast of Africa that occurred in 1913, was more elegant and was held to vindicate his theory of relativity. There are many disputes between evolutionists as to how the complex process occurred, and indeed as to how it began. Francis Crick even allowed himself to flirt with the theory that life was inseminated on Earth by bacteria spread from a passing comet. However, all these disputes, when or if they are resolved, will be resolved by using the scientific and experimental methods that have proven themselves so far. By contrast, creationism, or intelligent design, its only cleverness being found in this underhanded rebranding of itself, is not even a theory. In all its well-financed propaganda, it has never even attempted to show how one single piece of the natural world is explained better by design than by evolutionary competition. Instead, it dissolves into puerile tautology. One of the creationists' questionnaires purports to be a yes-no interrogation of the following. Do you know of any building that didn't have a builder? Do you know of any painting that didn't have a painter? Do you know of any car that didn't have a maker? If you answered yes for any of the above, give details. We know the answer in all cases. These were painstaking inventions, also by trial and error, of mankind, and were the work of many hands and are still evolving. This is what makes piffle out of the ignorant creationist sneer, which compares evolution to a whirlwind blowing through a junkyard of parts and coming up with a jumbo jet. For a start, there are no parts lying around waiting to be assembled. For another thing, the process of acquisition and discarding of parts, most especially wings, is as far from a whirlwind as could conceivably be. The time involved is more like that of a glacier than a storm. For still another thing, jumbo jets are not riddled with non-working or superfluous parts lamely inherited from less successful aircraft. Why have we agreed so easily to call this exploded old non-theory by its cunningly chosen new disguise of intelligent design? There's nothing at all intelligent about it. It is the same old mumbo-jumbo, or in this instance, jumbo-mumbo. Airplanes are, in their human-designed way, evolving, and so, in a quite different way, are we. In early April 2006, a long study at the University of Oregon was published in the journal Science. Based on the reconstruction of ancient genes from extinct animals, the researchers were able to show how the non-theory of irreducible complexity is a joke. Protein molecules, they found, slowly employed trial and error, reusing and modifying existing parts, to act in a key-and-lock manner and switch discrepant hormones on and off. This genetic march was blindly inaugurated 450 million years ago, before life left the ocean and before the evolution of bones. We now know things about our nature that the founders of religion could not even begin to guess at, and that would have stilled their overconfident tongues if they had known of them. Yet again, once one has disposed of superfluous assumptions, speculation about who designed us to be designers becomes as fruitless and irrelevant as the question of who designed that designer. Aristotle, whose reasoning about the unmoved mover and the uncaused cause is the beginning of this argument, concluded that the logic would necessitate 47 or 55 gods. Surely even a monotheist would be grateful for Occam's razor at this point. From a plurality of prime movers, the monotheists have bargained it down to a single one. They are getting ever nearer to the true round figure. We must also confront the fact that evolution is, as well as smarter than we are, infinitely more callous and cruel and also capricious. Investigation of the fossil record and the record of molecular biology shows us that approximately 98% of all the species that have ever appeared on Earth have lapsed into extinction. There have been extraordinary periods of life explosion, invariably succeeded by great dyings out. In order for life to take hold at all on a cooling planet, it had first to occur with fantastic profusion. We have a micro-glimpse of this in our little human lives. Men produce infinitely more seminal fluid than is required to build a human family, and are tortured, not completely unpleasantly, by the urgent need to spread it all over the place or otherwise get rid of it. Religions have needlessly added to the torture by condemning various simple means of relieving this presumably designed pressure. The exuberant, teeming variety of insect life, or sparrow or salmon or codfish life, is a titanic waste that ensures, in some but not all cases, that there will be enough survivors. The higher animals are hardly exempt from this process. The religions that we know of have, for self-evident reasons, also emerged from peoples that we know of. And in Asia and the Mediterranean and the Middle East, the human record is traceable back for an impressively long and continuous period of time. However, even the religious myths mentioned periods of darkness and plague and calamity, when it seemed that nature had turned against human existence. The folk memory, now confirmed by archaeology, makes it seem highly probable that huge inundations occurred when the Black Sea and the Mediterranean were formed, and that these forbidding and terrifying events continued to impress the storytellers of Mesopotamia and elsewhere. Every year, Christian fundamentalists renew their expeditions to Mount Ararat in modern Armenia, convinced that one day they will discover the wreckage of Noah's Ark. This effort is futile and would prove nothing even if it were successful. But if these people should chance to read the reconstructions of what really did happen, they would find themselves confronted with something far more memorable than the banal account of Noah's flood, a sudden massive wall of dark water roaring across a thickly populated plain. This Atlantis event would have adhered to the prehistoric memory, all right, as indeed it does to ours. However, we do not even possess a buried or ill-chronicled memory of what happened to most of our fellow humans in the Americas. When the Catholic Christian conquistadors arrived in the Western Hemisphere in the early 16th century AD, they behaved with such indiscriminate cruelty and destructiveness that one of their number, Bartolomeo de las Casas, actually proposed a formal renunciation and apology, and an acknowledgement that the whole enterprise had been a mistake. Well-intentioned as he may have been, he based his bad conscience on the idea that the Indians had been living in an undisturbed Eden, and that Spain and Portugal had missed their chance of rediscovering the innocence that had predated the fall of Adam and Eve. This was wishful piffle and also extreme condescension. The Olmec and other tribes had gods of their own, mainly propitiated by human sacrifice, and had also developed elaborate systems of writing, astronomy, agriculture, and trade. They wrote down their history and had discovered a 365-day calendar that was more accurate than its European counterparts. One particular society, the Mayan, had also managed to come up with that beautiful concept of zero to which I alluded earlier, and without which mathematical computation is very difficult. It may be significant that the papacy of the Middle Ages always resisted the idea of zero as alien and heretical, perhaps because of its supposedly Arab, in fact Sanskrit, origin, but perhaps also because it contained a frightening possibility. Something is known of the civilizations of the American Isthmus, but until very recently we were unaware of the vast cities and networks that once stretched across the Amazon basin and some regions of the Andes. Serious work has only just begun on the study of these impressive societies, which grew and flourished when Moses and Abraham and Jesus and Muhammad and Buddha were being revered, but which took no part at all in those arguments and were not included in the calculations of the monotheistic faithful. It is a certainty that these people, too, had their creation myths and their revelations of the divine will, for all the good it did them. But they suffered and triumphed and expired without ever being in our prayers, and they died out in the bitter awareness that there would be nobody to remember them as they had been, or even as if they had been. All their promised lands and prophecies and cherished legends and ceremonies might as well have occurred on another planet. This is how arbitrary human history actually is. There seems to be little or no doubt that these peoples were annihilated not just by human conquerors, but by microorganisms of which neither they nor their invaders had any knowledge. These germs may have been indigenous or they may have been imported, but the effect was the same. Here again one sees the gigantic man-made fallacy that informs our Genesis story. How can it be proven in one paragraph that this book was written by ignorant men and not by any god? Because man is given dominion over all beasts, fowl and fish. But no dinosaurs or plesiosaurs or pterodactyls are specified because the authors did not know of their existence, let alone of their supposedly special and immediate creation. Nor are any marsupials mentioned because Australia, the next candidate after Mesoamerica for a new Eden, was not on any known map. Most important, in Genesis, man is not awarded dominion over germs and bacteria because the existence of these necessary yet dangerous fellow creatures was not known or understood. And if it had been known or understood, it would at once have become apparent that these forms of life had dominion over us and would continue to enjoy it, uncontested, until the priests had been elbowed aside and medical research at last given an opportunity. Even today, the balance between Homo sapiens and Louis Pasteur's invisible army of microbes is by no means decided. But DNA has at least enabled us to sequence the genome of our lethal rivals, like the avian flu virus, and to elucidate what we have in common. Probably the most daunting task that we face, as partly rational animals, with adrenal glands that are too big and prefrontal lobes that are too small, is the contemplation of our own relative weight in the scheme of things. Our place in the cosmos is so unimaginably small that we cannot, with our miserly endowment of cranial matter, contemplate it for long at all. No less difficult is the realization that we may also be quite random as presences on Earth. We may have learned about our modest position on the scale, about how to prolong our lives, cure ourselves of disease, learn to respect and profit from other tribes and other animals, and employ rockets and satellites for ease of communication, but then the awareness that our death is coming and will be succeeded by the death of the species and the heat death of the universe is scant comfort. Still, at least we are not in the position of those humans who died without ever having the chance to tell their story, or who are dying today at this moment after a few bare, squirming minutes of painful and fearful existence. In 1909, a discovery of immense importance was made in the Canadian Rockies on the border of British Columbia. It is known as the Burgess Shale, and though it is a natural formation and has no magical properties, it is almost like a time machine or a key that enables us to visit the past. The very remote past, this limestone quarry came into existence about 570 million years ago and records what paleontologists familiarly call the Cambrian explosion. Just as there have been great dyings and extinctions during evolutionary time, so there have been energetic moments when life was suddenly profuse and various again. An intelligent designer might have managed without these chaotic episodes of boom and bust. Most of the surviving modern animals have their origins in this Grand Cambrian burgeoning, but until 1909 we were unable to view them in anything like their original habitat. Until then also, we had to rely upon the evidence mainly of bones and shells, whereas the Burgess Shale contains much fossilized soft anatomy, including the contents of digestive systems. It is a sort of Rosetta Stone for the decoding of life forms. Our own solipsism, often expressed in diagram or cartoon form, usually represents evolution as a kind of ladder or progression, with a fish gasping on the shore in the first frame, hunched and prognathous figures in the succeeding ones, and then by slow degrees, an erect man in a suit waving his umbrella and shouting, "Taxi!" Even those who have observed the sawtooth pattern of fluctuation between emergence and destruction, further emergence and still further destruction, and who have already charted the eventual end of the universe, are half agreed that there is a stubborn tendency toward an upward progression. This is no great surprise. Inefficient creatures will either die out or be destroyed by more successful ones. But progress does not negate the idea of randomness, and when he came to examine the Burgess Shale, the great paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould arrived at the most disquieting and unsettling conclusion of all. He examined the fossils and their development with minute care and realized that if this tree could be replanted or this soup set boiling again, it would very probably not produce the same results that we now know. It may be worth mentioning that this conclusion was no more welcome to Gould than it is to you or to me. In his youth, he had imbibed a version of Marxism, and the concept of progress was real to him. But he was too scrupulous a scholar to deny the evidence that was so plainly displayed. And while some evolutionary biologists are willing to say that the millimetrical and pitiless process had a direction toward our form of intelligent life, Gould subtracted himself from their company. If the numberless evolutions from the Cambrian period could be recorded and rewound, as it were, and the tape then played again, he established there was no certainty that it would come out the same way. Several branches of the tree, a better analogy would be with small twigs on an extremely dense bush, end up going nowhere, but given another start, they might have blossomed and flourished, just as some that did blossom and flourish might equally well have withered and died. We all appreciate that our nature and existence is based upon our being vertebrate. The earliest known vertebrate, or chordate, located in the Burgess Shale, is a 2-inch and rather elegant creature named after an adjoining mountain and also for its sinuous beauty, Picaia gracilens. It was originally and wrongly classified as a worm. One must never forget how recent most of our knowledge really is. But in its segments, muscularity and dorsal rod flexibility, it is a necessary ancestor that yet demands no worship. Millions of other life forms perished before the Cambrian period was over, but this little prototype survived, to quote Gould. Wind the tape of time back to Burgess times, and let it play again. If Picaia does not survive in the replay, we are wiped out of future history, all of us, from shark to robin to orangutan. And I don't think that any handicapper, given Burgess' evidence as known today, would have granted very favourable odds for the persistence of Picaea. And so, if you wish to ask the question of the ages, why do humans exist?